This is an ABC podcast.
Ben. Benjamin Law. Hello. Can you see me waving at you in our video chat?
I'm not technically supposed to, so.
What's the matter? Cat got your tongue? I mean, we're about to do a show together for a full hour, so now is not the time to freeze up, mate.
Yeah, but Beverly, I've been told that organisations are not to interact with citizens of Melbourne, and this has put me, Benjamin Yuknung Law, Sole Trader, LLC, a stickler for the rules, in quite a bind.
Good grief. Stop everything. Stop everything. I am a contraband not to be associated with citizen of Melbourne reporting for duty. Benjamin Law, I extend my gloved hand of friendship to you. Bring it in, buddy.
G'day, Beverly Wang. You know, I'm always appreciative of your glove of love, but I think right now, given the quarantine restrictions about citizens of Melbourne, I'm going to spray that glove thoroughly with some Glen 20 or antiseptic product. First, though, to one of our main preoccupations, the internet.
Developers.
I have filters on internet.
I'm really happy for you. I'm let you finish.
I took the initiative in creating the internet.
You have now started your surfing journey.
Love that theme. It's been a while. Why not hurl her out there for a run? Nice to hear your internet theme. Now, we are recording on a Thursday for a Friday, and overnight, U.S. President Donald Trump held a rally for young Americans at a mega church in Phoenix, Arizona. There was a big crowd there. Photos show us that there was no mask wearing. And this was on the same day the state recorded 3,600 new cases of COVID-19.
And here to expand on all of that is Dr. Norman Swan. No, I'm just kidding. We are not CoronaCast. The reason why we're talking about that on Stop Everything is because over the weekend, another Donald Trump rally, yes, another one, was the subject of much internet debate. Was that event's very poor turnout the result of TikTok and K-pop activism? So just to recap, you probably saw all of those photos online that had empty stadiums. The turnout was very poor. Donald Trump slouched out of Air Force One, very, very cowed by the low turnout. And it was said that it was young activists who did that. But is that actually true? There's been a lot of debate. So to guide us through this dense and murky bog, we have Cam Wilson, an internet reporter. G'day, Cam.
Hi, good to be here.
Hey, we really need your help. I mean, just generally, but also to sort through fact from fiction. Are you up for the challenge?
I'll see what I can do.
Beverly, what's the first challenge?
So conundrum number one is something that has taken over a lot of bandwidth on the internet this week. This is the Donald Trump rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma. That was his first campaign rally since the coronavirus pandemic began. Prior to the event, they were boasting about more than 1 million ticket requests, but when rubber hit the road, only about 6,000 people showed up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. A lot of the news headlines at first were giving credit to teenage TikTokers, Zoomers, otherwise known as Gen Z, and K-pop stans for this, showing up of Donald Trump. But it's a little bit more complicated than that, I think. Can you take us through what happened?
What happened was that there was groups of people on the internet, different communities, who all decided at various points and not led by any leader to sign up for tickets for the Trump rally, which inflated their expectations about how many people were going to come. The motives behind it, you know, it's a little bit unclear. You know, one of the main users who wanted to, I guess, organize people to come and get involved and decide to troll the campaign, in effect, they're a 51-year-old TikTok user who took, umbrage at the fact that the rally was originally scheduled on the day, or on Juneteenth, which is an important US commemoration of when slaves were freed, and also a day that when one of the greatest acts of racial violence in America had happened before. And so what she did is she posted a video to her just only 1,000 fans, but it spread further, saying, hey, maybe that we should get involved and essentially try and embarrass the campaign.
Somebody on another TikTok post commented that he was offering two free tickets on his campaign website to go to this rally. So I went and investigated it. It's two free tickets per cell phone number, because when you register, you have to give them your cell phone number. They send you a code. You put the code in and your tickets are reserved for you. So this probably means, having worked on a political campaign this past fall, it probably means that I'll start getting text messages from his campaign. All I have to do to get rid of those is text stop. That's all you have to do. Once you text stop, they have to stop texting you. That's the law. They have to leave you alone. So I recommend that all of those of us that want to see this 19,000 seat auditorium barely filled or completely empty, go reserve tickets now and leave him standing there alone on the stage. What do you say?
Mary Jo Lopp, I think she's called TikTok Grandma on TikTok. She put out this question about, hey, what if we all went onto, we as in the people who would do this, went and reserved tickets for the Trump rally and see what happened. Can we really sheet a lot of the responsibility to TikTokers and K-pop stans? Is there more to it than that?
Yeah, look, I think it's kind of complicated, because the way it kind of works is that, some people would put up videos and other people would say they would do it, but there's really no way to understand, how many people were involved. Look, it's difficult. We've got, one group of people, the campaign, who we know exaggerate things. So it's hard to understand, just what really happened from their side. But this other side of this kind of a conflict that's happening on the internet that was, there's no way of really being able to understand the scale of their organizing efforts.
Cameron, so much of your work explores the lines between fact and fiction. And as we spend more time online, sometimes that can be really difficult to tell which is which. One of the big examples for a lot of Australians right now is the cook, and I guess the big social media presence online, Pete Evans, the TV host. He's been making headlines for all the wrong reasons lately. What's going on, and what should we know?
What's going on is exactly the question that I've been asking when I've been watching it as well. Look, Pete Evans, since about like March or April this year, has really, really stepped up the kind of conspiracy theories that he's spreading. And for a while, he has really pushed ideas that aren't always founded in science. They're not really backed up by fact. Mm. But he really stepped it up, kind of coinciding when we all started bunkering down in our houses because of the coronavirus lockdown. He started, spreading these, I guess, like coronavirus denialism. So he, would really, really cast doubts on scientist claims. He took aim at Bill Gates, who has been kind of the boogeyman for many of the conspiracy groups during the coronavirus, because Bill Gates, of course, is active in many of the efforts to, find a vaccine and that kind of stuff. And he really, really has stepped up some of the things that he's been sharing.
Is he, and what's going on, representative of something bigger that's happening in Australia right now?
Yeah, look, I think the thing is, he has for a long time been involved, or at least kind of aligned with the idea of wellness. And it's a very complicated idea, something that my colleague at the ABC at the moment, Ariel Bogle, has done great work recently on. But, a lot of it is kind of being almost like the opposition to mainstream medical culture. Many of these conspiracies are cross-pollinating, is that they are united by a distrust of authority, but also the desire for a simple kind of answer. And that's one of the things that, conspiracy theories do really well. They say, well, you don't understand this complex problem like the coronavirus, because, we were learning about it as it moved really rapidly. Well, rather than scientists being like, well, we're not sure about this, someone can be like, well, actually, I am sure about this. This is the truth. It's this one thing, it's that coronavirus doesn't exist, or if it does exist, it is as mild as the cold. It's a very human emotion to want to understand things simply. But I think the thing is we also have to look at the people who are spreading this. Very often people like Pete Evans have a natural commercial incentive. I think at this point, we can probably say that Pete Evans, along with many other people spreading these conspiracy theories, there's no point in paying attention to them anymore. They've decided that, they don't want to engage the truth. It's not in good faith. And therefore, as much as we can, I think we should probably just start ignoring them.
Cam, you've investigated all of this, and so this is based all on your research. But I guess the counterpoint is that Pete Evans has, 250,000 followers on Instagram alone. People are believing him. People are defending him. How does Pete Evans defend himself?
A common feature of how many people who are spreading conspiracy theories act is that what they do is they say, I'm just asking questions. In some ways, they take advantage of, I guess, the transparency that the scientific method kind of has, which is this idea that, you know, if you're developing something new, or if you, even if it's not a science thing, but if it's a policy thing, if you're transparent about the pros and cons, many times these like bad actors will kind of take advantage of this transparency and jump on that.
I wonder, Cam, if it's no coincidence that all of this is happening at a time when media is so fragmented, when we've got an older demographic that's probably more susceptible to believing conspiracy theories online as they've been raised to believe what they see in print, but also a younger generation that is vulnerable to the fact that they haven't been raised with a loyalty or an allegiance to traditional media outlets. With all of that in mind, what's the kind of a toolkit that you recommend or a checklist that we can go through when trying to figure out whether something online is actually real or not?
I mean, it's a really tough question, and there's so many different ways out there that, you can see information selectively and that can be used to manipulate something to draw a conclusion. You can see things that are just outright fake. So it's very difficult sometimes. So I just kind of use my common sense. I say, is this too good to be true or is this too bad to be true? You know, is this something that is so extreme that I have to kind of doubt it? And, you know, many of these kinds of, you know, many people who try and manipulate, the media, or just kind of, you know, the way that information spreads, what they'll do is they'll try and find content that reinforces the beliefs that you might already have. And so I guess if you see something and you're like, that is exactly what I believe, maybe just take a second to be like, well, maybe I should doubt whether it's true or not, because that's the first thing. I guess the second thing is, you know, you can always do a bit of research yourself. You can look and see if you can find trusted sources that maybe corroborate something or point out that it's not true. And I guess the final thing is, as we've moved away from traditional media, we are all now our own source of publishers, because we can post something on Twitter that other people can see, or even just looking at it outside of the digital world, if we see something, we believe it, and then we tell it to other people, well, then they're likely to believe it as well. So I think with that kind of understanding, we should essentially be like, we have a responsibility, all of us, to be careful about the information that we pass on. If you're not sure whether something is true, you can always just decide not to to share it yourself. You may, in fact, stop the spread of misinformation, which can harm people.
That sounds like really good advice for all of us, I think, who are involved in family group chats and all of those ways that we communicate now. We see all those posts from our relatives. So everybody, a little bit of responsibility there in pushing back when it's not factual can do probably a lot of good. Cam Wilson, internet reporter at your service. Thank you so much, Cam.
Thanks, Beverly. Good to be here. Thanks, Ben.
My name is Ken Lin. This is my 6-part podcast about the Christian hip-hop band that changed my life.
Give it up for Crush Friend!
This is a nightmare.
Imagine how stuck God would be. He'd just be sitting up there in heaven and he'd just be munted. He'd be pinging on the Holy Spirit.
They shone brighter than the Star of David, but were destroyed faster than Sodom and Gomorrah.
And that's when I began to drink the sacramental wine.
What sort of a Christian are you?
What's with all the Jesus shit, mate?
Okay, I'm pulling over. Does anyone else need to vomit?
What the hell is going on?
And why am I making this podcast? Because Crossbred were really cool.
Ben, that's from the trailer of a new ABC comedy podcast called Crossbred. It's a 6-part mockumentary series about the rise and fall of twin Christian hip-hop duo Josh and Joan Burns, also known as Crossbred. Ken Lim is the narrator. He's Crossbred's former social media manager, played by comedian Aaron Chan. And listen to the names associated with this podcast. It's written by Declan Fay. He's the co-writer of Ronnie Chang, International Student, actor Chris Ryan, and ARIA Award winner Megan Washington. Chris and Megan also play the roles of Josh and Joan Burns, the crossbred Christian rapper siblings.
Megan Washington, you mean the mother of my godchild, Beverly?
Pardon my ignorance, Ben. I grew up in a Buddhist, ancestor-worshipping, Taoist, Confucian, secular Christmas-celebrating household. I know nothing of Christianity. If you are the godfather to her child, does that make you Megan's god-husband? happened?
Oh, look, I don't know. This all sounds very suspiciously close to heterosexuality. I suddenly don't feel safe. We can work it out later.
Well, let's ask Megan. She's there. You can hear her chuckling in the background. Megan Washington, welcome to Stop Everything. What do you say? Are you and Benjamin Law bonded in heavenly marriage?
Yes. I can't believe you have to ask. Of course we are.
Actually, there was an incident that we shared together in Berlin that would confirm that. But that's another story for another time. Megan, you're a co-writer on this series and new podcast. On paper, it's a pretty out there idea. It's kind of like the band The White Stripes meets evangelical Christianity. How did this idea even come about?
Well, the idea started with Chris and Declan, who actually met as teenagers at Christian youth camp. And Chris brought me into the project when I told him something that I don't often tell a lot of people, but I told him that I was born again as an evangelical Christian when I was 14, which is what happened. So once we realized that we all had this sort of, mutual experience within, the church, we thought it was really ripe, terrain for us to work on it all together. And for me personally, because I was born again at 14, obviously I'm not anymore. I don't identify like that anymore, but I really did for a couple of years there. And it was actually my first experience with kind of rock and roll, per se, I think happened for me within that, setting, because the church that I fell into was really evangelical, and there was a lot of music and really amazing singing. And it was I used to go to Hillsong. And so the fusion of, I guess, worship music and stagecraft and all of the things that come with entertainment, showbiz or whatever, for me, they were kind of born at the same time. So for me, it was a very natural fit to take this journey into a musical space.
So that's you at 14 drawn into the church via the music, which is one of the huge draw cards of these kinds of big evangelical churches. Now you say you're not born again. This is clearly a comedy podcast, and it's signposted as having strong language and containing content that may offend. As a comedy podcast, you're poking fun of this institution that you used to be a part of. So can you talk a little bit about how you went from being a believer to now, I guess mocking it?
Yeah, well, I would probably suggest that we're not really making fun of religion in the podcast any more than we make fun of the music business or whatever. For me, I guess the reason that I no longer really identify as a Christian or whatever is because I sort of worked out that place you get to, that feeling of connection with humanity and the planet and that sense of spiritual kind of heart lift, I guess, that I used to find in those moments. I find sometimes now in yoga class, and I find listening to jazz, and I find when I run or when I exercise, when I laugh with my friend, I feel like we find it. And as humans, I think we're sort of always on the search for that sort of thing. And I think the joke is it's all around us everywhere. And that's kind of, I guess, how I learned to expand my spiritual identification, I guess. And now, some people, they get there by having pingers and raving. I guess for us in the podcast, in the show, it was very important to us that we didn't sort of bag out on religion, because at the bones of it, all religion is the same, right? It's love yourself and each other and the earth. That's kind of that's the message. So and that's why at the end of episode 6, Ken has his speech about why he makes the podcast, which is not to make fun of religion, because he's a Christian in the show.
So you're not mocking, but at the same time, this is a deep satire. And of course, when an audience hears crossbred, they're probably going to involuntarily word associate that with Inbred. So this is a fictional comedy podcast about a brother-sister Christian rap duo who give themselves this moniker for better or for worse. Tell us more about these two characters, where they came from, and this unfortunate name with which they're now associated.
So Crossbred was, unfortunately, it was my idea. But so, you know, Joan and Josh are kind of, you know, they're based, obviously, Chris and I are close. We work a lot, you know, together, and like we have a pretty, you know, like a pretty siblingsy relationship. And I, you know, we really liked them working as a pair because each has something that the other lacks, you know. And, you know, Josh has enthusiasm and he just goes for things without any planning. And, you know, Joan is the more sort of strategic, a bit more, you know, cunning sort of energy. I mean, having said that, like, the show is pretty, you know, goofy. So, you know, it's not like a Pinky and the Brain situation or anything like that. But we really wanted them to feel connected. And I guess, you know, like the show begins, I don't want to give away any spoiler alerts, but the show begins with, you know, them both having a mutual problem that they choose to solve by competing in this Christian, like, battle of the bands thing to win the prize money or whatever. And they, unfortunately, they are really good, and that's their problem, and that's where, you know, takes them on their journey. So it was really fun show to write. I mean, it was really fun for me because I write a lot of songs, but I've never really written any rap, and it was such a gift to be asked to write raps when I knew I wouldn't have to rap them. It was such a joy. It's a bit like writing opera that I can't sing. I'm like, oh no, no, you figure it out. So it was really fun to write for Chris, and you know, trying to come up with rhymes for, I don't know, characters in the Bible, and just pretty absurd, but it was a really it was a lot of like fun to create those characters, and I feel like we were able to really sort of lean into, I was really able to lean into a place that I'm not often able to go in terms of creative expression.
Yeah, that's right, because I think most of Australia knows you as a singer, as an ARIA Award winning singer. I think we don't really think of you as a comedy person. Working with someone like Declan Fay, I'm sure you get a really strong mentorship in comedy writing. This was a whole new direction for you. How did you find writing for comedy?
Well, I love it because I didn't really realize that there was such a strong connection between storytelling through songwriting and just storytelling, because the way that you think as a writer in a writer's room about the reasons and like what you plant when and why, you know, how you do all that stuff, like that's all the kind of thinking that I think about a lot in terms of like, you know, like my songwriting, and also as I'm like moving more into music theater, like that's all very natural. So it just kind of, it was just the next sort of step for me. And, you know, Deck was super, you're right to highlight that, you know, Beverly, because, you know, Deck was really like, they brought me on as a composer. And the first thing I said was, why is the sister, why is she Christian? And so I got really excited about, you know, Joan as a character, and I was like, no, she should be a rat bag and blah, blah, blah. And so we just kind of fell into it. It was just very like natural, you know, sort of thing. And they were really supportive and really welcoming of me into that creative space. And it's somewhere that I intend on spending more time for sure. I love it. Mm.
So Megan, you are part of this new ABC podcast called Crossbred. At the same time, of course, we foremost know you as a singer-songwriter and a live performer, and we're interviewing you socially distanced because of COVID. This era has really affected live performers especially, and I'm curious to know, what's this period been like for you as an artist?
Well, as a parent of a toddler in lockdown, I feel like that arts aside, like, you know, trying to make space to be, you know, creative in that sort of environment was pretty tricky. In terms of live stuff, like, obviously nobody really knows what's going to happen, and I've tried to be as productive as possible, and like now I have a finished album, which is really exciting. It's coming out on the 28th of August. It's gonna happen. It's finally finished. Only took me 6 years. So I've been like, it's a terrible business model. I just like to you know, to take this opportunity to say that if your album takes you 6 years, you're doing something wrong. But I I feel like I have been trying to be as productive as possible, but it is very weird to not know or have any sense of when I can go back to do the thing that I identify the most with doing, which is like singing in front of other people.
Absolutely. Well, Megan, congratulations on Crossbred. It is quite a hilarious ride and a great and interesting departure for you. Crossbred is a new ABC comedy podcast. You can catch that on the ABC Listen app or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And it sounds like Megan has an album coming out on the 28th of August. So please look out for that as well. Thanks so much, Megan Washington.
No worries. Thank you so much, Beverly Wang and Benjamin Law.
Crossbred is also running a competition. How very unorthodox of the ABC. But all you have to do is praise and worship Crossbred. So post about the podcast on social media. It can be anything, photo, text, video, TikTok tent, meme, using the hashtag CrossbredPodcast. So that's bread, as in the yeasty food substance, carbohydrates, CrossbredPodcast. Screenshot your post and email it to crossbred@abc.net.au and you could win a very special Crossbred memento. Hallelujah. Peace be with you. Here's some music from the podcast.
Listen up, y'all. Time to fess up. Want to tell you a little story how I messed up. You consider this song a confession, all about ending up in the wrong profession. Donut shop, Forest Hill Chase. Caught in a food court, what a disgrace. 2 months max because I needed the dough. Still I'm needing the dough and that was 6 years ago. Stuck, staring at the same faces. Stuck like chips in a fat kid's braces. Stuck with a wage not more than minimum. Like quicksand, stuck in the cinnamon. But one day at the counter there's a man with a beard in a white robe and sandals. Oh man, that's a bit weird. Halo on his head and it's golden glowing. He's like, hey Josh, how's it going? I'm like, how'd you know my name, bro? He says it's on your chest. And when it comes to names, I've never been stressed. I said, I feel like I've seen you before. Do you work at the time zone near the barbecue's galore? He says, nah man, I work everywhere. I fly around the world and I answer your prayers. And speaking of requests, before I drop the mic, I want an orange mocha frappuccino on ice. So I'm scooping the ice out of the freezers. I go, name for the order, and he goes, just Jesus.
Hey, Ben, normally we'd be talking about EOFIS. You know, we love a good
financial year.
Mid-year roundup. We aren't doing a full EOFIS show this year because, frankly, it would be too depressing to sum up 2020 so far. But like, if we could just do a little toe touch into that, what would a short kind of Cliff's Notes of 2020, the year, look like so far to you?
I want to talk about pop culture given the remit of our show, but all I can see is just fire and plague. It's been a biblical year, Beverly. But if we do pivot to talking about TV shows and films, I think it's been a really big reckoning year. Black Lives Matter has obviously detonated conversations in every kind of space around the place. But when we're talking about screen content, TV shows, films, we've already talking about stuff that's been taken off distribution and streaming. We've talked about our wrestle with whether we're okay with these things anymore. So that would be a collage for 2020.
Yeah, you know what I think, right? You talk about fires, you talk about smoke, you talk about COVID, Black Lives Matter, blackface. We talk a lot about blackface in this part of 2020.
It just keeps happening in Australia.
I think what we're living in, I've been thinking about this for a while, now I'm going to say it. We are living in Watchmen season 2. You know how Watchmen was just one season, a beautiful season, and they weren't going to make any more? I think that's great because it stopped and then we picked up in real life. We are here. How is Watchmen season 2 treating you?
I mean, look, we should probably recap if anyone hasn't seen HBO's Watchmen, which I do think was the show of 2019. And one of those really kind of foundational shows where you start actually seeing the world differently. You know, it's like after you watch Get Out, the kind of comedy horror by Jordan Peele, and everything is kind of cast in a new light. And Watchmen is very much about people realizing that the monster is in the basement. The phone call is coming from within the house, and the house is the structure of the workplace and community in which you work and live. You know, we're talking about structural racism. And so now with all of these kind of shows, I mean, when you ask me how 2020's sequel to Watchmen is treating me, you know what I feel most of all? And this is coming from a place where everyone's feeling the same thing. I feel exhausted, actually. I think a lot of people, when they're like, oh, do we have to talk about Chris Lilley Do we have to talk about Gone with the Wind? Do we have to talk about Little Britain and Fawlty Towers? Do we have to wrestle with this? I think everyone feels exhausted, but for different reasons. I know I kind of feel exhausted having to go through these arguments over and over again. What about you?
Yeah, you know, when these stories come up, I think we all get the same feeling. You and I and our producer, Jay, were like, oh, here we go again. And sometimes the critique is that we appear to be obsessed with race. It's our favorite topic. We just can't get enough of it. The fact is, it is truly exhausting to continually grapple with these stories, the volume of it. If I had a choice, if this wasn't the thing, the topic of the moment, I'd happily talk about something fun and frivolous. But the thing is, it has got hold of us. And it's our job to every week, Ben, I say we're going to wrap ourselves around another internet mess. And we do wrap ourselves another internet mess. So I guess that's what EOFIS 2020 Watchmen Season 2 on Stop Everything looks and sounds like.
Of course, this week we've seen a new kind of conversation come up. I don't want to call it a scandal because I don't think that's what it is. And I don't want to talk necessarily about cancellation because I feel like one of the things that exhausts me is this conflation between canceling and criticism. I feel like if you want to criticize any text or creator or artist in 2020, people get really defensive and say, oh, so you're canceling them now? I think a valid criticism is sometimes what needs to be offered, especially when you look at things retrospectively. So this week, a big conversation about Tina Fey and 30 yes. Rock. And this was triggered off by Tina Fey, the creator of 30 Rock, the co-creator with Robert Carlock, who asked for 4 episodes of that really, really funny show that I love, but it does contain 4 episodes of blackface to be taken out of syndication and off streaming services. Beverly, did you follow this story?
I did. It's really interesting, right? Because in the last couple of weeks, we've been talking a lot about Chris Lilley's shows that feature blackface, brownface, and yellowface being pulled from Netflix. There's a big conversation around Gone with the Wind being temporarily removed from the HBO Max streaming service in the States to return with more context. Little Britain taken off the BBC streaming service. An episode of Fawlty Towers that used the N-word multiple times was taken off a UK streaming service briefly and then got reinstated after John Cleese and others protested. So this is very much in the vein of all those other conversations. What I think is really interesting is that this is kind of a self-reporting of blackface that we have not seen in previous instances. I think the timing is interesting. Next month, many of the key cast members of 30 Rock are going to do an NBC Universal upfront in character. So it's a bit of a reunion. Right. And I just wonder whether in the timing, this cultural conversation we are having, it would behoove them not to have to deal with a negative conversation about blackface when they're gearing up for like a really exciting event to reunite the cast. So it's a preemptive strike from Tina Fey and Robert Carlock.
And I guess it makes sense, right? Rather than being called out, canceled, criticized, all of that stuff there. Look, they're saying up front, look, we have made mistakes that we can't stand by in 2020, given the current conversation. From Variety, Tina Fey wrote to the platforms saying that the episodes are, quote, best taken out of circulation, and she apologized, quote, for the pain they've caused. The full statement's really interesting. She writes, as we strive to do the work and do better in regards to race in America, we believe that these episodes featuring actors in race-changing makeup are best taken out of circulation. I understand now that intent is not a free pass for white people to use these images. I apologize for the pain they have caused. Going forward, no comedy-loving kid needs to stumble on these tropes and be stung by their ugliness. So this feels like a moment where it's quite professional in tone. It's like admission of saying we could have done better and we would like to retrospectively fix that. At the same time, I did see the internet reaction was quite interesting around this. A lot of people very grateful for the response, but also some people saying, actually, if you look at 30 Rock and the work of Tina Fey with new eyes, there have always been some problems with it that go even beyond these depictions of blackface, especially with the Asian American and Native American communities.
Yeah, it's an interesting line in that statement I understand now from Tina Fey, because Tina Fey has been asked about racist portrayals in her work before, including The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, a Netflix series. As recently as 2015, she stood against apologizing. You know, there's a quote here about a culture of demanding apologies, and I'm opting out of that. She said that in 2015. In 2020, she's really signaling a new understanding. When you talk about other portrayals and work, so remember in Mean Girls, there was the Asian nerd clique.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are critiques of rape and transphobic jokes in 30 Rock. In Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, Jane Krakowski's character, Jacqueline White, is a white-passing Native American, and her parents are played by Native American actors. So it's all there. It's on the record. I think the trope of casting a white actor to play a Native American and then have her surrounded by Native American actors, we see a really similar thing happening in Jonah from Tonga, where Chris Lilley in Tongan brownface is surrounded by Pacific Islander actors. And I think by having that combination together, I think sometimes it lends the aura of complicity to some kind of sense of approval that it's okay. You know, I'm wrestling with my own view of this right now, Ben, because a part of me is cynical. Surprise, I have a bit of cynicism in me. I don't know if you'd noticed it, but I'm a little bit skeptical. I'm a little bit cynical. And when I see that Tina Fey is asking for these four episodes to be removed from 30 Rock, a little bit of me wonders whether it's a protective move, whether it's kind of like a preemptive scrubbing of the career legacy.
I mean, I want to lean into the complications around this conversation even more, because I think, you know, my instinct is to always embrace the complexity rather than shy away from it. And hearing what you're talking about, you know, when you've got actors who are actually Native American or are Pacific Islander background surrounding these people who are dressing themselves up essentially to play one of their own, one, it brings up the question of complicity, but two, you also want those actors to have work, right?
Oh, absolutely.
In a media space and art space where there are so few opportunities for many non-white actors, you want to be able to see them on screen authentically portraying themselves. Let's break this down further. As an actor, should you have the capacity to play anyone you want? That is fundamentally your role and profession. On some basic level, your role is to be able to portray characters and experiences that aren't your own. I mean, that is so much the mission statement of so much of art. But at the same time, you know, like, I don't, for instance, have a problem with gay actors playing straight people, right? I do have a problem with cisgender people playing trans people. Now, why is that? What accounts for that? It's about history and it's about power. So when it comes to history, there is a history of white people dressing up as black people for minstrel shows, making fun of race. And that's a part of a huge kind of era of slavery that we in Australia also have. We have a history of blackface. So when people here say that didn't happen here, you need to Google that. You know, that is uncontested, that blackface and slavery both happened in Australia. Has there been a history of straight people taking gay roles? Well, yes. But has there also been a history of gay actors playing straight people? Yes. So I don't feel like there's a real tension. I know other people from the queer community disagree with me, but I do feel there is a tension between trans and cisgender actors, because that there is a history of theft of those roles that need to be acknowledged.
Yeah, that's a really important and powerful point that you make. Just going back to the conversation about opportunity. Yeah, absolutely. What the complicated factor of being a person of color actor, being asked to take the roles where you surround, you know, the white actor in blackface and whiteface, is that you're being asked to make a compromise about the humanity of who you are and your people at the same time that you are given an opportunity that is probably so rare for you. So to always have to be in this bind where the opportunity is there, but you also then have to weigh up what you're paying for that opportunity, I think comes down to the core and the pain of that. When people express that pain of having to see that and the really complicated nature of it. I have to admit, when I first watched Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt and I saw the Jacqueline White character playing a white passing Native American, I didn't think enough about it. And I look at it now, 2020, and I think, why didn't that stick out more to me?
Mm.
What was going on that I, a person who thinks a lot about this, didn't really say, hang on a second, this is weird.
Yeah, it's exactly like those of us who've enjoyed Gone with the Wind. As I said the other week, when I watched and laughed along with Little Britain at what I now see are really racist and transphobic jokes. I mean, did I find them funny then? Yes. Have I grown as a person and changed? Have I read more deeply? Have I made more friends from diverse backgrounds? All of those things, I think, is about, they speak to growth. They reflect growth, both us as individuals and as a community. It actually also reminds me of this great piece in GQ magazine that I read previously. I think it's from 2015. It's by John Ronson, called You May Know Me From Such Roles as Terrorist Number 4. And it's just these interviews with Arab American actors who've been forced to really pick from this small pool of roles, and they completely compromise and have to sell out because that is what the industry demands of them. So these are real, as much as they may be abstract philosophical discussions for us, this is about work and opportunity for real people trying to make it in the industry and have been traditionally excluded. But it also makes me think of another conversation that's going on this week, Beverly, about the Netflix animation Big Mouth. What's going on over there?
Well, Jenny Slate is one of the cast members of Big Mouth, but she has announced this week that she is going to leave this cartoon series because she, as a white actor, doesn't think it's appropriate anymore to voice a black character named Missy. And she said in a statement, "Ending my portrayal of Missy is one step in a lifelong process of uncovering the racism in my actions."
Mm.
So again, we're talking about this journey of understanding. When you take a role and you think, well, like you say, it's an animated character of a black character. It's just a voice, you know. Mm-hmm. Do we racially profile voices? Shouldn't it be okay? All of these questions that get raised. And I think when you want to make a project work and when you want to have an opportunity to work, all of your actions are going to be towards arguing in favor and making the case to make it okay. Right? Mm-hmm. Until something happens and you have to stop in your tracks and really assess. Something similar has already happened previously with the show BoJack Horseman, the animated series also on Netflix, and Alison Brie voicing the character of Diane Nguyen, who's a Vietnamese character.
Right.
And the creator of BoJack Horseman, maybe it was 2 years ago, saying in a really long interview, a big mea culpa of a lot about the casting of that character and about the creative impetus in that show and how, looking back, he wouldn't do that. Not to take anything away from Alison Brie's performance, but looking back now with fresh eyes, that's the wrong move to make. And I mean, just as a side note to that, a sort of a spin-off or an offspring of BoJack Horseman was Tuca and Bertie, which was an amazing one-season animated show starring the voices of
Ali Wong and Tiffany Haddish, right?
Yes, as best friends. Mm-hmm. That was a really lovely show. It took the story of young women in the animated format in such a deep and thoughtful direction. It was canceled, and there was a lot of outrage. I'm really happy to see that a second season has been commissioned. So again, I'm going to draw it back to the conversation of taking shows off streaming services that have racist, outdated content. The bigger question should be, what are you going to replace it with? What are you going to add in that's going to enrich our viewing options? And I think, maybe is this a sign that they're rethinking their choices?
You know, Beverly, whenever we have these conversations on Stop Everything or even online, I can always see that one Twitter person at the bottom of the thread who's like, okay, so you don't have a problem with that, but I have why don't you have a problem with like two human beings playing birds? You know, explain that for me. Riddle me that, Beverly Wang. And it's kind of like, you know, these conversations always remind me of like, well, you wouldn't say that about it. You wouldn't say what you said about white people, about black people. You wouldn't say that about these strange equations and acrobatics that people make. And it assumes that, you know, you can take it to the most ridiculous kind of form, like talking about humans and playing birds, and is that cultural appropriation? But I think it always just comes down to these basic concepts of, is there a historical precedent for theft? And also, who holds the power in this situation? So, you know, like when you talk about a white actor playing a Vietnamese role, you know, that is problematic to me. But if it was the other way around, if it was an Asian actor voicing a white character, I wouldn't have a problem with that, because there is no kind of historical precedent of that many Asian actors voicing white characters in cartoon series to the detriment of the white acting community.
Right. It would be a quirk and a one-off, not a pattern, a systemic pattern of
Correct.
Behavior.
Okay. What are we excited about this week, Beverly? Well, it's probably the same thing that everyone else is excited about now. You know, there are people all around me who just know the Hamilton soundtrack off by heart. There are people around me who might be non-religious, but they have made their own religious pilgrimage to America to see Hamilton the musical. Everyone is Hamilton obsessed, and Hamilton is now coming to television.
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter, daughter to your union, revolution. And the hope that you
This is Hamilton.
There's so much hype around Hamilton, isn't it? I mean, like you said, Ben, people taking pilgrimages. In Australia, a run of Hamilton was supposed to take place in March 2021 at Sydney's Lyric Theatre. And I remember the announcement around that. There was so much excitement, so much talk about who the cast will be or when the tickets will be released. You know, we're living in a pandemic. Will the pandemic be with us in March? I, as a Melbourne citizen, we'll probably not have the opportunity to travel to Sydney and associate with all of you to watch Hamilton. Even
not
if
sure
I was,
do.
No, I'm a contraband material. So the fact that it's going to be widely available, albeit on a paid streaming platform service, Disney Plus, but here's a hot tip. You can probably get a free trial. it's going to be a big deal. I am looking forward to watching it because I've heard so much about it. And finally, I get to lay my eyes on it. And it's going to be the Broadway cast as well. Lin-Manuel Miranda is going to be in it. All of the original people are going to be in it. So it's a big deal.
Yes. So Hamilton, this blockbuster musical created by Lin-Manuel Miranda, it won the Pulitzer in 2016, tells the story of the American founding father, Alexander Hamilton. As much as it responds to the fact that we can't go to theaters anymore, this is also responding to the fact that we can't go to cinemas any longer.
Yes.
Because this was supposed to be a theatrical, and by theatrical, I mean big screen release. That is just multiplexes, especially in the United States, are just not going to open for quite some time. In Australia, they're just about to. Jason DeRosso, our friend from The Screen Show, will have more info about that. But this is not going to happen in America. And I think as much as this is a really great moment for us to finally see Hamilton on stage, it dovetails with those other conversations about accessibility in the arts. The fact that it doesn't matter if you can't afford a flight to the United States. It doesn't matter if you, Beverly, can't afford health-wise or financially to fly to Sydney, but everyone will be able to access this blockbuster musical from home. And that's a really exciting thing. I know that I will definitely be putting on the popcorn and slipping into my Long Johns for this. What's another trailer that has people in their feelings this week?
Are you ever not in your Long Johns?
I'm broadcasting in them right now.
I may or may not be wearing leggings. I don't know. You can't see the bottom half of me. The other trailer that has a lot of people in their feelings is this Babysitter's Club reboot.
Oh my God! Good afternoon, Babysitter's Club. This is Christy Thomas, president and founder speaking.
Christy, I know how much you like to be in control.
But Watson, it's gonna be a part of your family, whether you like it or not. I'd rather have head lice. Again,
I'm Dawn. I just moved here from LA.
I'm chill, but I don't back down from a challenge.
Uh-oh. Someone needs a diaper change.
Toodaloo.
Grounding breath. Yeah.
It's me, Claudia Kishi. I'm good at a lot of things.
Most of all, I'm good at art.
The Tootsie Roll Pop is very compelling.
Thank you.
We have to celebrate.
Hey, guys. Watermelon gummies.
Ben, you grew up surrounded by sisters in the 80s and 90s. I'm sure you would have been across this Babysitter's Club by Anna and Martin.
You know, the funny thing is I should have probably gotten into Babysitter's Club myself. I was more of a Goosebumps boy. This was a phenomenon that really captured Generation X and maybe the older millennial set. And even though I wasn't one of the people who was obsessed with Babysitter's Club, I get the sense that this reboot is very timely and, like those Disney live-action CGI remakes, is going to kind of hit that sweet spot of a demographic that was obsessed with this franchise as a child, as an adolescent, and now have children to pass it on.
It's a reboot. It's an update. So that scene in the trailer where the phone rings, they make a really clear point of being like, this is a retro phone. I got it from Etsy. So it's going to be that kind of thing. Very nostalgic, steeped in it, because you know who's in it? Alicia Silverstone, right?
Alicia Silverstone from Clueless, and who was in Batman and Robin, directed by the late Joel Schumacher. That's a throwback.
You take Alicia Silverstone from the classic Clueless, from released in 1995, and then you add in Christy, Marianne, Claudia, and Stacey from the Babysitter's Club. That was from the 80s and 90s. You've basically got a perfect recipe for female, late Gen X, old millennial catnip. Like, that's a thirst trap for the female X's and the millennials who are now late 30s, early 40s, probably got kids of their own. And you're right, they're going to entrap them in the same trap. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how they update these characters. I guess, especially because, you know, Claudia Kishi as one of the few contemporary Asian American characters in YA at the time, she's kind of an icon among, you know, Asian diaspora females of that era. Claudia is renowned. She's famous. She's a hero. She's an icon. So let's see how Claudia looks in this reboot.
Beverly, you seem to know a lot about the Babysitter's Club universe. Can I ask you a question? And it's not about your medical history, but what is your relationship to the Babysitter's Club?
To be honest, I am more of a Sweet Valley High girl.
Oh, so, wait a Sweet minute. Valley Were High... there like camps? Is this like Home and Away versus Neighbours? What are these two camps?
I think I was just a little too old to really dive into the Babysitter's Club. I saw them around and I was like, that's a little bit babyish. I'm already reading Sweet Valley High. Sweet Valley High also got turned into a TV show, and it is a story of Jessica and Elizabeth Wakefield, two identical twins from Southern California who share a Fiat Spider convertible, and they are exactly as you would imagine, the perfect blonde California twins. And this series of books by Francine Pascal, this is all from memory, this is all extemporaneous, Benjamin, is iconic, landmark, hugely problematic. I think much more problematic than Babysitter's Club. So I'm a little bit before it, but I recognize the Babysitter's Club. I respect the Babysitter's Club place where it stands in the pantheon of YA. So welcome.
Well, you know what I respect, Beverly? I respect your knowledge of these franchises. You were luring me into it. I'm sure there's some young people in my life that I might be able to watch the Babysitter's Club reboot with. But look, I think that might be all that we have for this week. If you have some thoughts about Babysitter's Club, about the conspiracy theories that your family has been sucked into, or maybe you've been watching Crossbred and you have some thoughts about its portrayal of evangelical Christianity, do get in touch. We'd love to hear your thoughts. art@abc.net.au is our email address. Again, that's art@abc.net.au.
Jade Clark, we thank you as always. Also, big thanks to Selwyn Cousins and Sky Kirkham. We will catch you next week. Take care.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.